Before I begin this sermon, if you'll just give me 1 minute, we are in the process of making our own kids' material for the Bible classes. So basically, we like to write our own material from the 2 and 3 year old class all the way to the 5th grade class instead of having to buy it. And so some of us and some ladies have been working on getting a schedule together and a syllabus. And now that we've got a syllabus down pat, we need help actually writing the material. So this is a call for help. Help. This is going to be a massive undertaking. And we're going to have about 1.5 years before we'd like to implement it. But we're looking for a lot of sisters that are willing to help us write material for those classes from 2 years old to 5th grade. So if you're a sister and that's something that you'd like to be a part of, we're going to have a meeting on February the 13th at 3 o'clock about coordinating our teams and how we're going to split into groups and how we're going to go about writing that material. And there's 3 things I wanted to say about that. One, if you're a sister and you've never taught class before, or maybe you've quit teaching, or maybe you're very new to this congregation, if you would like to help, we more than still want you to come and help. Because again, we need the help. As well, and after we all have benefited from experienced teachers and teachers that had a lot of talent, but I think back on my life, you know what I really benefited from? I just benefited from sisters that cared, and they gave me their time and their energy to teach me the gospel. So if you're a caring sister, you are more than qualified to come and help us write this material. And it's going to be a group effort. It's not something you're going to be stuck doing all by yourself. And so there's some other people you get to work with, and you get to be a part of that if you're willing. The second thing I'd like to bring up is that I know a lot of us that are ladies, we have a lot going on, and we have very busy lives. A lot of us have kids. A lot of us have jobs. We have other things going on. And it's our intention to be as flexible as possible with that. So please don't let that deter you from wanting to help if you want to help. And the third thing I want to say about that is, if you can't come on February the 13th, come and talk to somebody, and we'll make sure you get in a group even though you can't come to the meeting. Because again, this is going to be a team effort. It's something that we want you to be a part of. And if you are very interested, I have some sheets that I'll be sending in the foyer that gives you some more information about that. But again, we're looking for ladies to help us write that children's class material. And if you think that's you, we would be more than happy to receive your help on that. So thank you for that little announcement. That'll be February the 13th. Now, let's get to what we need to talk about for my time. Let's talk about finding Moses in Jesus. Jason opened up a couple of weeks ago that we get to reuse sermons that we made videos for the lockdown. And so this is going to be the one that I always wanted to preach, but I only had a video for. So you may recognize some of this, but it's coming from that video several years ago. What I'd like to do with you this morning is just connect Moses to Jesus. And since out here in this adult class, we've been going over Jesus, and since the small auditorium adult class has been going over Moses, we're going to shake hands with those two classes and bring out some of those easy-to-see connections that Moses has made with Jesus. Instead of, however, going to Exodus and just trying to do an overview of Moses in Exodus, let's go to Acts chapter 7. And we're going to use Stephen's sermon to teach us about Moses and Jesus. All Stephen is doing as he's before the Sanhedrin is he's trying to make the point that the Jews have a habit of rejecting God's messengers. And so he explains that first with Joseph. And now here, starting in verse 17, he explains that with Moses, that Moses was a rejected messenger of God. And then after Moses, he moves on to Jesus and says, Jesus is the messenger of God that you rejected. So let's do this long reading, if you'll bear with me, and then we'll come back and we'll make some points from the reading that we just did. Let's start in verse 17. But when the time of the promise drew near, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till another king arose who did not know Joseph. This man dwelt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so they may not live. At this time, Moses was born and was well-pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. But when he was set out, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and brought him up as her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and the mighty, and was mighty in words and deeds. Now, when he was 40 years old, he came into the heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. And the next day he appeared to the two of them as they were fighting, and he tried to reconcile them, saying, "Men, you are brethren. Why do you wrong one another?" But he who did his neighbor wrong pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Do you want to kill me as you did the Egyptian yesterday?" Then at this saying, Moses fled and became a dweller in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. And when 40 years had passed, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire in the bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. When Moses saw it, he marveled at the sight. And as he drew near to observe, the voice of the Lord came to him, saying, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses trembled and dared not look. And the Lord said to him, "Take your sandals off your feet, for the place which you stand is holy ground. I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their groaning, and I have come down to deliver them. And now come, I will send you to Egypt. This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you a ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. He brought them out after he had shown them wonders and signs in the land of Egypt, and in the Red Sea and in the wilderness 40 years. This is the Moses who said to the children of Israel, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. Him you shall hear.'" And of course, that "him" right there at the end is Jesus, is who Moses foretold. So that'll serve us well as we move forward. Let me begin with a question. Why do you believe in Moses? I imagine that if you came to a church building on Sunday morning, you probably all believe in Moses. Why do you believe in Moses, though? There's probably lots of good answers people could give if you were really questioned all of a sudden. You know, maybe you would point to Jewish histories and say, well, obviously the Jewish kingdom existed at one point, and certainly they had a founder of their commonwealth, and that founder must have been Moses. You could point to the Old Testament canon, and you could talk about the authenticity of the Old Testament canon, how for some very strange, weird way that book has stayed together all these years, and say, well, I believe in Moses because of how well this canon was preserved. And I think that would be a fine answer. You could also point it to the Gentile histories and ask the question, you know, if we don't believe in Moses, why did all these ancient Greek historians believe in Moses? That they would have been a lot closer to the events of Moses than we were. I think those are all fine answers. But what's really the best answer? Why do you believe in Moses? I'll tell you why I believe in Moses. It's because I believe in Jesus. That's the reason why I believe in Moses. I don't live in Moses' commonwealth. I'm not a Jew. I don't live in the places that Moses brought the people in. I don't live under the law that Moses gave. But I do all those things for Jesus. I live in Jesus' kingdom. I practice the laws that Jesus gave. And since Jesus believed in Moses, I go along with that, and I believe in Moses too. I really think that's the best answer. We see Moses through the eyes of Jesus, and that's why we believe in Moses. Now, if you think to the first century, was that the case? Did all of those people in the first century believe in Moses because they first believed in Jesus? No, it was the other way around in the first century. In the first century, they did live in Moses' kingdom. They all believed in Moses. And the people that joined the kingdom of God, they believed in Jesus because they first believed in Moses. And they would say, well, I believe in Jesus because I believe in Moses. It was the other way around from us saying, I believe in Moses because I believe in Jesus. I know that's a tongue twister. We're going to say it and explain it again a little bit later. But that's Stephen's argument here. If you believe in Moses, you have to believe in Jesus. And I would argue today, if you believe in Jesus, you have to believe in Moses. What I'd like to show you as we begin is show you some of those Gentile historians. And if we look at them, I think it paints this very neat picture about what the concept of Moses was as he moved out through history. In the fourth century, A Greek historian named Hecataeus wrote this about Moses. He's talking about Moses. He says to persuade the multitude to use written laws was, and that's the word Moses there, a man not only great of soul, but also in his life, the most public-spirited of all lawgivers whose names are recorded. Now remember, Hecataeus is not a Jew. He is a Greek living in the fourth century. But what does he believe in? He believes in Moses, and he believes that Moses was this very spirited lawgiver, and there's not a lot of supernatural things going on in Hecataeus' account like it is in Exodus, but he does believe that Moses was the leader of the Jews and that he gave them that law. It progresses into something a little different as we go forward. We also see Artapenaeus, and that is the hardest one to say out of these guys. Artapenaeus in the 2nd century BC. He is living in Alexandria. Actually, I don't know. I take that back. I think I just made something that's trouble. If you're listening online, I did not just mean that he lives in Alexandria, because someone will question me on that. That is not where Artapenaeus lives. In the 2nd century, finally, after escaping another plot by killing the assailant sent by the king, Moses fled to Arabia, where he married the daughter of Jethro, the ruler of the district. And he gives another account of Moses as well. And again, there's not a lot of supernatural things going on, but he does believe in Moses, and he believes in the general Moses story. He believes that Moses took the Hebrews out of Egypt, and he married Jethro's daughter, and he led the people out. The best historical account outside of the Old Testament that gives us Moses is Strabo in 24. Strabo is living in Alexandria, and Strabo gives us a very good detailed account of Moses, but there's one thing missing in the story. The story is almost identical to Exodus except for one thing, and it's a big thing. He misses God. The whole conversation is Moses is doing these miracles, he's doing these wonders and signs, but Strabo gives all the credit to Moses. And there's no mention of God at all. And he says, Moses, he did these plagues and he sent them on the Egyptians and he was able to deliver his people. But that one's the closest to the Exodus account that you have. This, you see, we're building up to a point where Moses is getting removed from the story of Exodus and he's becoming something else. By the time you get into the 1st century, you have Tacitus write about Moses. And I think Tacitus gives us a very good idea of the way that Gentiles thought about Moses in the 1st century. And he says about Moses that, you know, there was this motley crowd that was collected and abandoned in the desert, while all the other outcasts lay idly lamenting. One of them, named Moses, advised them not to look for help or gods or men, since both have deserted them, but to trust rather in themselves and accept his divine guidance of the first being by whose they all should get out of their present plight. Moses to Tacitus, and he's living in Britain and he's a Gentile. He says, you know, Moses was a real person, but the Jews have this whole story about him. I don't believe the story. What I think Moses was is he was just this like Spartacus figure, and he led a rebellion into the desert. And certainly the Hebrew people were developed from him, and they ultimately came from him. But Tacitus sees Moses as more of a legend than as a real person. So as we've moved further and further away from Moses in time, Moses has descended into legend. Now, this is the whole point of why I'm doing this. That is said in the 1st century. In the 2nd century, all of a sudden something changes. And the world depiction of Moses changes drastically. That's in the 1st century. But in the 2nd century, all of a sudden you have people like Justin Martyr give you an expectation of what Moses is or who Moses was. And Justin was very proud that he was a Gentile and he grew up pagan. And this is what he believes about Moses. He says, I will begin then with our first prophet and lawgiver, Moses, that you may know that of all your teachers, whether sages, poets, historians, philosophers, or lawgivers, by far the oldest in the Greek history show us was Moses, who was our first religious teacher. You know, Tacitus says Moses is a legend, but then like 30 or 40 years later, Justin Martyr is a Gentile, and he's like, Moses, our first lawgiver, our first religious teacher. And he says, you can look to the Greek histories. They prove of the things that he did. Certainly the Greek histories that we just summarized. What changed? Why did Gentiles think Moses was a legend? And now all of a sudden in the 2nd century, we're saying Moses was our first religious teacher. He was our first lawgiver. What changed? You know the answer. Jesus came to earth. That's what changed. And Jesus believed in Moses. You got to think for a moment that people in the first century thought Moses was a legend, but then all of a sudden apostles show up to your town and start working miracles. And apostles teach you about their first prophet, Moses, and how he gave these prophecies that pointed the way to Jesus. Now that you believe the apostles and you believe in Jesus, well, of course you believe in Moses. He's a part of that story. What changed in the Gentile concept of Moses? Jesus changed. And as Jesus shows up and now we believe in Jesus, it changed the public depiction about who Moses was. Now we live in a world where, even though some people will say this is not true, I found it every day to be true. The majority of the people on this planet right now believe in Moses and Jesus. Now, they don't necessarily believe everything that they taught. Certainly not that. But they do believe Moses and Jesus were divine and they were messengers of God. When the majority of the world even believes that today, what does that prove? That Jesus made an impact in the first century. And we're still living in the consequences of that impact, which is people believe Jesus. And now we believe in Moses. So why do we believe in Moses? We believe in Moses because of Jesus. That's the correct answer. And I think those little histories prove it to us. Let's move on. Let me talk about those connections we want to make. There's a reason why Stephen preaches these people Jesus through the life story of Moses. And it's because of all the connections that these two men have. The first one, let me bring up, is that they both were threatened as babies, right? In 719, and I think this is kind of interesting, the day that the small auditorium class was doing baby Moses in the river, we were doing in here Herod killing all the babies in Bethlehem. We were literally teaching the same class, but from two different events. Verse 19 says, "This man dwelt treacherously with our people and oppressed our forefathers, making them expose their babies so they may not live. At this time, Moses was born, and he was well-pleasing to God, and he was brought up in his father's house for 3 months. They hide him in the Nile, but who is he found by? Pharaoh's daughter, who raises him as her own," right? Now, how does that apply and connect to Jesus? Jesus as well, threatened as a baby. In Bethlehem, sometime when he's under two, Herod finds out that the Messiah is supposed to be born in Bethlehem somewhere around now, and he calls for all males under two to be executed. Now, the angel warns Joseph what's going on, and guess where they decide to flee to, or where they were told to flee to? Egypt. Pharaoh's daughter saves Moses. And who saves Jesus? Egypt saves Jesus. So there's even a little nice connection there. Both were threatened as babies, and both were delivered by the Lord. Another connection we can make between these two, they were both rejected deliverers. Look at verse 35 again, talking about Moses. "This Moses, whom they rejected, saying, 'Who made you ruler and a judge?' is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush." Moses was the deliverer there, but he was the rejected deliverer. And he pulls back to the thought that when he tried to free the people back when he was 40, they said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us?" The answer could have been God, but it hadn't been the right time yet. So they were rejected there. If we kept on reading in verse 38, we learned that while Moses was at Mount Sinai, they rejected Moses again when they started building the golden calves and saying, "These calves brought us out of Egypt." And Moses has to get after the people again. Finally, if you remember how Moses died, complaining back to the people who were complaining to him. And he strikes the rocks and he says some things and takes some credit for things he shouldn't have taken credit for. And God says, "You're going to have to die because of that." And he doesn't get to enter the promised land. Moses was rejected so bad by the people that he ends up being punished, getting back at them, fussing at them. Of all the characters you've read about in the Old Testament, would any of y'all like to take the shoes of Moses? You know, some of us have a few kids, and our few kids complain to us while we're in the car. Do you enjoy that? Can you imagine having a million people in the back of your car for 40 years complaining to you? That was Moses' life. And ultimately, he died because of it. Moses, even though was this revered person by the Jews in the first century, he was a rejected prophet. They treated him terribly. Now, what's the connection to Jesus? Jesus is the same story. He is sent by God to be the deliverer. And what do ultimately the people do to him? They reject him. They hate him. They conspire to murder him, and they succeed. Now, he's resurrected, but they get away with what they're trying to do here. Jesus, too, is the rejected deliverer. Now, to even take it a step further, that Exodus generation that hated Moses and complained and rejected Moses, did they still believe in Moses, though? And I'm not talking about in terms of believing about his teachings and having faith. I'm talking about, did they believe, though, that Moses really came from God and was sent by God? They did. Even though they rejected Moses, they still believed he was real and he was the real deal in what he claimed to be. If you look back to chapter 7 and look in verse 36, why did the Exodus generation believe Moses was actually the real deal? Verse 36 says, he brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt. Why did the Exodus generation believe Moses was really from God? Because of his miracles. That was the reason. You know, when the 10 plagues come, you can't deny that Moses is at least doing something. But especially when he leads you out through the Red Sea and you walk through that parted sea, you believe that Moses was sent by God for a special mission. There's no doubt in your mind. Now, even though you've seen all the miracles, and even though you've seen all the signs, does that automatically mean, though, that you're going to obey what Moses tells you to do? Those people in the Exodus generation, they believed in the miracles, but they rejected the teachings of Moses, didn't they? And that's why they rejected Moses. Can I now take that to Jesus? For y'all that have been sitting through the Matthew class, did the Jews ever complain to Jesus about the miracles? Do the Jews ever go get the paralytic and say, no, lay down, stay down, you know? We were talking about the other day how Jesus wasn't just healing the lame, he was healing the maimed. Lame is someone who has a broken leg. Maimed is someone who's missing a leg. Jesus was healing people that they were maimed. He was like growing back legs and stuff. Did the Pharisees and Sadducees ever accuse Jesus of lying about the miracles? Not once. Why did they never accuse, or why didn't anyone ever accuse Jesus of lying about the miracles? Because they couldn't deny the miracles. Even the people that killed Jesus believed in the miracles. So if they believe in the miracles, why do they still reject Jesus? Not because of the miracles of Jesus, but because of the teachings of Jesus. Moses, you can believe the miracles, but you still hate the teachings. Jesus, you believe in the miracles, but you still hate the teachings. And can I even argue that today, in 2022, the issue is not whether you believe in the miracles. The issue is whether you accept the teachings. Because we're dealing with the same issues that they were dealing with back then. You know, no one can argue to you that the miracles weren't real. You got to explain why we're even talking about Jesus. You have to explain why we even know about Moses. If Jesus never was raised from the dead, would there be a group of Gentiles sitting in Alabama talking about Moses this morning? You know, there would have had to be some kind of event to cause the Christian explosion in the first century. There had to be some kind of catalyst, and that has to be the miracles of the apostles. That when those people saw the miracles, they told their kids about it, they told their grandkids about it, and everyone believed that the miracles were real. They couldn't deny them. But why did they still ultimately reject Jesus? They didn't have an issue with the miracles. They had an issue with the teachings. And even today, people will tell you up and down they have an issue with the miracles. But what do they really have an issue with? They have an issue with the teachings. And I feel like sometimes when we can direct the conversation to that, that's when we end up being successful in those conversations. It's not about rejecting the power. It's about rejecting the teachings. And that's what Moses and Jesus both had to deal with. Going on with this, one day I'll learn what the forward button is. They both worked in God's perfect timing. Look at verse 23. And what's so interesting about this, this is something that the Holy Spirit teaches us in the New Testament that wasn't in Exodus. We don't get this in Exodus. In verse 23, It says, now when he was 40 years old, he came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. Verse 25 is key. For he supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, but they did not understand. We don't get this in Exodus. We know that Moses murdered the Egyptian, but we don't get Moses' intentions for that. It says here that Moses' intentions was that he wanted to deliver the people at 40. We don't get that in Exodus. He tries to deliver the people at 40, but does it work? No, he has to run and he has to flee from Pharaoh. It's not until he's 80 that God turns him around and says, okay, now free the people. But he was trying to do it back when he was 40. Moses tried to deliver the people at the wrong time, and did it work? No, it didn't work. He had to do it during God's perfect timing. Can you imagine Jesus coming at a different time than he did in the first century? You know, what if Jesus came in the days of Josiah? Would have Jesus been very successful? One of the main arguments is that Jesus is saying that I'm the one who Moses prophesied about. In the days of Josiah, when they've lost the law, he would say that and people would have gone, who is Moses? And why do we care about Moses? That would have been a terrible time for him to come. What if he came during the captivity? Certainly people were caring a lot more then, but Israel was spread out and all over the place. There wouldn't even been a people there in that area for him to teach. When Jesus comes, he comes at the perfect time where people begin to start caring about God again, and now he actually has someone to debate. Now he actually has someone to teach. And even the Pharisees serve a very important purpose, giving him those things for him to teach about and really give him some competition so he can really prove his glory and his power over them. As well, going again with that thought, even though Moses was rejected at first, by Jesus' day, he was revered by the Jews. Moses was hated when he was alive, but look how people feel about him in chapter 6. Stephen, who's also someone who did miracles, but they couldn't prove against the miracles, they have to come up with false witnesses to try to murder him. In chapter 6, starting in verse 10, talking about Stephen, and they were not able to resist the wisdom and the spirit by which he spoke. Then they secretly induced men to say, we have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and God. Can you imagine a culture that reveres a man so much that when they accuse you of blasphemy, they accuse you of blasphemy against that man and God? They put this man's name right by God's name. And they say, Stephen has committed blasphemy against Moses. Does this culture revere Moses? Oh, they love Moses. And that's why Stephen is using Moses to make his point. Ultimately, Moses was rejected. But by Jesus' day, he was revered by the Jews. And Jesus uses that to make a connection. Jesus and the apostles used that very love for Moses to prove his identity. Look in Acts chapter 26. Acts chapter 26, this is Paul teaching King Agrippa. King Agrippa's dad was a Gentile, but his mom was a Jew. And evidently, King Agrippa was very good to the Jewish people. And many people believe that he was, in fact, Jewish, at least converted. And I think Paul gives credit to that. Let's start in verse 21. Paul tells this to Agrippa. He says, for these reasons, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. Therefore, having obtained help from God, to this day I stand, witnessing both to small and great, saying no other things than those which the prophets and Moses said would come, that the Christ would suffer, that he would be the first to rise from the dead, and he would proclaim the light to the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. Paul says, the only reason why I'm in prison is all I've done is repeated the things that Moses prophesied. That's why I'm in prison. Now, verse 27 is when he appeals to King Agrippa. He says, King Agrippa, do you believe in the prophets? I know that you believe. If you had to go and be anywhere, this would be a cool thing to see, I think. But that Paul has given this sermon about Moses and the prophets. And then it's almost as if he walks up to King Agrippa in that room and says, King Agrippa, do you believe in the prophets? And then he says, King Agrippa, I know you believe in the prophets. Evidently, King Agrippa believed in Moses. And he revered Moses like every good Jew did. Now, because Paul made that line about him believing in the prophets, what does King Agrippa respond with? Verse 28, then Agrippa said to Paul, you almost persuade me to become a Christian. Now, I know that when we read this line, we always like to go, now, almost persuaded ain't good enough. And we'll sing the song, Almost Persuaded, and we'll teach it to our kids and say, almost persuaded is still bad, right? I understand that. We have to teach that sometimes. But I want us to look at this from a positive spin. Is this actually a really incredible thing that King Agrippa says, you almost got me there, Paul? How did Paul almost get him? By the line, I know you believe in Moses. All I'm doing is teaching Moses. And King Agrippa is almost persuaded at that moment to jump into the gospel. That's incredible. And I think, again, that shows you what the purpose that Moses' story serves in the first century. They revere Moses. And now Moses is just a link to Jesus. If you believe in Moses, you have to believe in Jesus. And if you believe in Jesus for us, you have to believe in Moses. And let's use actually when Jesus did that himself. Look at John 5. This is a nice parallel to King Agrippa's story. In John 5, Jesus says it himself. In verse 39, Jesus says, you search the scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life. And these are they which testify of me. But you are not willing to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive honor from men, but I know that you do not have the love of God in you. And look down and out at verse 45. Do not think that I accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, in whom you trust. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote about me. What did Jesus just say there? He's been saying what we've been saying all morning. If you believe Moses, you have to believe in Jesus. He says, if you read those scriptures and you hunt for them for eternal life, you would have come to realize that I am the thing that the scriptures talked about. I am the very thing that Moses instructed you. He says even in verse 44, don't think that I just accuse you. 45, don't just think that the Father accuses you. But he says, even Moses himself accuses you of your unbelief. Was the problem the miracles? The problem was never the miracles. The problem was the things that Jesus were teaching. And even Moses endorses Jesus, but hearts are still hard and they're still not willing to believe. And one more here. Peter saw Moses and Jesus together. And something is said there at the Mount of Transfiguration. Since we used Acts, let's just use Luke. Luke chapter 9. In Luke chapter 9, look what happens when Peter sees Moses and Jesus together. Everybody wants to ask the question, how does Peter even know it's Moses? It's not like there was pictures of Moses and he recognized his picture. All we know is that he knows it's Moses. And that could have happened by the conversation that they were having. He overheard. Or it could be that God just needed Peter, James, and John to know that's Moses and Elijah, so he made sure they knew. You know, it doesn't matter. What matters is that he saw them and that something especially was said by the Father. In Luke 9, verse 28, it says, now it came to pass about 8 days after these sayings that he took Peter and John and James and went on the mountain to pray. And as he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered and his robe became white and glistening. And behold, two men talked with him who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. But Peter and those who were heavy with sleep, and when they were fully awake, they saw the glory of the two men who stood with them. And it happened, as they were parted from him, that Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here. And let us make you three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing when he said. Peter sees Moses and Elijah and Jesus. And we've already made the point that the Jews revere Moses. And Peter has this great idea. Peter says, Lord, it was good for me to be here. He says, let me make you an altar, and I'll make you an altar, and Moses an altar, and Elijah an altar. And really, Peter thinks he's doing Jesus this great favor. He's putting Jesus on the same level as Moses and Elijah. And Peter thinks he's giving Jesus this great honor, but somebody interrupts. When he says that, a cloud comes, they all become fearful. And verse 35 says, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, this is my beloved son. Hear him. Peter thought he was giving Jesus this great honor, but what had Peter actually just done to the Son of God? He insulted him. Is Jesus on the same level as Moses? And I know we've been making the connections all morning, but is Jesus on the same level as Moses? The Father says, uh-uh, this is my beloved Son, not Moses. You hear him. Moses is the one who's humbled, and Jesus is the one who's exalted by God. God himself endorses Jesus. And I need to make that point before we wrap up. When we make these connections, they're wonderful, and the shadows make the point abundantly clear. But there is one thing that we have to leave at when we have these conversations. Is Jesus just a little part of Moses' story? No, it's the other way around. Moses is just a little part of Jesus' story. Jesus is the real deal. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is what Moses was working for. Moses is a servant in Jesus' house, but Jesus is the one who owns the house, right? Even with all of that being said, Moses is still just a servant, just like we are. And that's why God endorsed Jesus over Moses there at the Mount of Transfiguration. Thank you for your close attention. And maybe that list will be helpful to us as we move forward and make the dots. As a way of invitation, going back to a point that we've made several times, I know that there might be someone that's really struggling with the concept if Moses and Jesus were real people. And I'm not trying to shame anyone about having those issues. You know, I'd love for you to come and talk to me. And there's some things that we could talk about, and I think it'd be helpful to you. And what I'm about to say, I'm not trying to shame that person. I'm hoping the best for that person. But let me make this point. In thinking about the grand scheme of things, believing that Jesus was real is the easier thing to do. Just believing that Jesus is the Son of God, that's not necessarily very difficult. Believing that Moses really was sent by God to send the plagues and part the Red Sea, that's not really incredibly difficult either. And as I've already said, when I walk down the street, the majority of people everywhere already believe that. That Moses was a real person, he was really sent by God, and they believe Jesus was really the Son of God. People will tell you that and not even think twice about it. What's the real difficulty? The difficulty is the teachings. Jesus' kingdom, you only get in if you're willing to submit to the teachings. If you can submit to the teachings, though, what do you have? As Jesus says in John 5, you have eternal life. But that's the challenge. If there's here with someone today, I probably bet you already do believe in Jesus. The question is, are you going to submit to Jesus? If you're willing to submit to Jesus, this group has no more wish than one to help you with that. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing?